How are you doing, people? Thanks for listening and welcome to episode number 15. This one's a chat with Rachel Wright, who's a British photographer based now on the west coast of America, working in the editorial and advertising worlds. We talk about her journey into photography, which came via a stint in various PR roles for agencies and record labels, and how this eventually ended her up living and working in the States. You should check out Rachel's work at www.rachelwright.com. That's Rachel, A-E-L. And you can also follow her on Instagram at Rachel Wright Photo. And yeah, check out what she's up to over there. For anyone interested, I've got some neutral exposure discount codes for Capture One Pro. So if you've been thinking about how to get the most out of your images with the best RAW processing software on the market, then get in touch and I can get you started with 10% off. You can drop me a line via Instagram at neutral.exposure, or you can email me through the website asphoto.uk. Yeah, it's a really nice chat. I hope you enjoy it. This is Neutral Exposure with Rachel Wright. Welcome to Neutral Exposure, a space for reflection and inspiration with photographers across a range of disciplines. My name's Al Simmons.
Nice to meet you too. How are you doing?
I'm good, thanks. Yeah, not bad. I'm having quarantine fringe issues, so I might not be able to actually see you for a lot of time.
I'm no one to comment. Yeah. I mean, it seems like I've been in quarantine. Well, yeah, 11 months of quarantine with this. But how's life anyway?
Good. Yeah, pretty good. Weird, obviously. It's fine. I'm actually kind of getting into the groove of this quarantine thing, and every time someone talks about it ending, I'm like, oh, I like it.
I know what you mean. Yeah, I know what you mean.
It's weird how it just becomes normal.
Yeah. I came back to work 2 weeks ago, and I thought it would be a bigger shift to come back to it all, but actually it's not been too difficult. I kind of missed having the free time to do this kind of thing.
I know. It just gives you the space to kind of entertain ideas and thoughts and just do whatever you want.
And not have
like people emailing you asking for shit, and it's just like, I just do whatever I want.
This is actually kind of nice.
This is how it should be.
Have you been shooting at all over the last, what's the situation like at your end?
I'm in near San Francisco. I'm just near like Oakland, Berkeley, so just across the bay. And they were quite early with their lockdown.
The cool bit, right?
Apparently, yeah. Although the bit I'm in doesn't seem all that cool. But lockdown happened a bit earlier here than everywhere else because they're a bit more of a progressive place, and the mayor just, you know, we didn't have any leadership from the president. So the governors and mayors of each place have their own powers. So she just decided like to take it on and lock everybody down early. But I don't know, it's a bit weird because everyone's coming out of lockdown a bit early, which means...
It's the same thing here.
Yeah, it's... I don't know. I'm off all social media at the moment and don't really look at the news that much. I look a little bit, but only just to kind of get the gist and be like, okay, still don't want to know. Yeah, it all just seemed a bit overwhelming and it was a bit much, and I think I was just getting to the point where I just wake up feeling like and going to sleep at night like the doom scroll on your phone. And since I've stopped all that, I'm just a lot calmer and quieter, and it sort of feels like the 90s again where we didn't have the internet or social media and just it's pretty chill. But I don't know what's gonna happen here. I guess nobody can know. I think that's the worst bit, it's the uncertainty and the unknowns.
Sure. And I mean, I think the UK and the US, even though they're the ones who most speak about being ahead of the curve and, you know, we've got the best in the world, like, well,
it's embarrassing.
I mean, it seems like you got it all wrong.
Oh my god.
It's a disaster.
It's embarrassing on like both countries. It's just, oh my god. But I don't know, hopefully we'll style it out and it'll be fine.
Hopefully. Eventually. So well, I like to try and get all of the lockdown chat out of the way right at the beginning, Because I don't want this to be a, so what are you doing during lockdown?
Yeah, because it would be a very short, boring interview with me.
Not very much.
Yeah. I'm one of the people that has just like not been very productive, and it's been kind of great.
Yeah, well, it looks like it would be difficult to try and do your work from a living room.
I've done like other stuff. Like I've rebuilt my website and I sorted out my entire archive, like that I thought would take a day, and it took a week, and the website took like 3 months. And I just sort of went back to the beginning of everything and just looked at it all again with fresh eyes and rebuilt everything from scratch. And that's actually been a lot more.
That sounds
useful.
Nice.
Yeah, it's been a lot more helpful and useful to me to kind of be reflective and like really have a think about what I've been doing and what I want to be doing and how to like draw a line through those things. Mm. Still don't really have any answers for that.
No.
Not like fully formed answers, but yeah.
Did you come across anything that was like a nice pleasant surprise to find? I often find, you know, when you open that catalogue or open that hard drive again, there's often like just these little things where it's like, oh yeah.
I never
finished that.
Yeah, because I've always had this thing of like I pick out favourites from a shoot and I will put them in a separate kind of Lightroom catalogue, and that's like my archive catalogue. And usually when I rebuild a website, I'm trying to get done as quickly as possible because A, I hate doing it. B, I hate going through old work. And see, I'm usually working, so I haven't got time to kind of give it my full. So I just like it. I just go back to the same old stuff and look through it. And so I got sick of doing that. So instead of doing that, I went back to like the original catalog and looked through all the raw files, just see if there was anything I'd missed that maybe my eye then didn't like. And now I do. And there are a few things I was like, one out for that one's like, quite like that, and mostly it was like, oh my god, I was bad, like so it was nice to see some improvement.
When you can kind of see that, like that definite shift where it's just like, oh yeah, before, what was I doing before then?
Yeah. And also just like looking at old stuff and seeing that it's terrible, but also looking at it a bit deeper and being like, I can see what I was getting at. I can see what I was aiming for, but I just didn't have all the tools, like physically and in my brain, to achieve what I wanted to achieve. But there's like the beginnings of what I do now. It's all still there, and it kind of like there's like an evolution, which has been interesting.
So how would you maybe sum up that, or kind of what did that process show you about how you'd evolved in a style, or kind of what had changed in your work?
Just seeing the common threads, really, and seeing, like, you know, looking at a shoot and kind of remembering, like, oh god, that one was a nightmare, or oh, that one was really fun, if depending off if it's like an assignment thing or just something I go off and do on my own. Just trying to kind of look for what that common thread through everything is, because, you know, you read a ton of stuff about, like, you've got to find your style and everything's got to look like it comes from the same person. And I kind of feel like that's difficult, because say if you're a celebrity portraitist, you're doing personal work, but unless you're like best mates with some celebrities, you can't.
You can
make portraits of ordinary people, but they don't have that same, like, people like looking at portraits of famous people because there's an interest, they know a bit about them, and those people generally have a lot of charisma that kind of comes through an image, hopefully. And so a lot of my portrait stuff is famous people or known people, and then a lot of my personal stuff is kind of going out into the middle of nowhere and finding desolate landscapes and stuff. And I was like, well, I don't, what is the common thread? But like a few things that I found, like I did a shoot with Hosier for his press shots a couple of years ago, and it was actually interesting seeing the locations that I put him in very much married the two. Like there's one of him next to like a neon motel sign that I found in LA. It's moody and dark, and it has the neon, and it has that kind of mid-century classic Americana thing that I like. And so I was like, oh, I married the two things there. And just going through what I like and what I don't like and what I want to do more of, and just trying to sort of cut out all the noise of what you should be doing and and doubling down on like, no, this is what I want to be doing, and I believe in this. And if you don't like it, go and look
that's what I'm doing.
Which is really difficult.
Yeah, I can imagine. Yeah. Well, I was trying to find a common thread throughout your stuff, and I settled on, well, there's a couple of things, but I think joy is definitely there, which is really nice to see. You know, there's kind of,
I like that.
In both the commercial and the personal work, you know, there's a real kind of like a sense of adventure and a joy for life, which is kind of refreshing, especially,
yeah.
I mean, if this is a result of your website edit, nice work.
I think that's why I haven't been in, like, this whole lockdown experience, I haven't been inspired to do anything, because, you know, I would see people's projects and like doing Zoom photo shoots and FaceTime photo shoots, and I just look and I was like, oh, I don't, it just, you're just taking screenshots. Like, I saw a couple I saw a couple of fairly creative ones, but generally speaking I was like, that's not what I want to be doing at all. And then like the porch portrait things, it was just, it got to the point where it was just overdone and people like just trying to be productive. And I just thought, you know what, it's a pandemic, not a productivity contest. I don't feel inspired. Every time I went out for a walk or something, walking around the neighborhood, just looking for stuff, just to kind of keep my brain active, and there's nice light around here in the evening and things, I just felt really sad and lonely, because there was nobody about. And there was something I took a camera out one evening, and I liked, I think something that is a common thread, I like taking pictures of life, and that sometimes involves people and it sometimes doesn't. But I find that when it doesn't involve people, there's like a suggestion of life there. So like where people have been at one time, or just a suggestion of life. I liked that about walking around the neighborhood with a camera, and just kind of like being able to see in people's windows and seeing that everybody was home, and you could hear people like blasting music out because they were home, or you could smell them cooking their dinner, and you couldn't actually see any humans. But, and then people leaving shit out on the street, like free books and things. And there were just like these little suggestions of life everywhere. And I liked that. But other than that, I feel like after all this is over, if I ever see this kind of situation, like someone on Zoom or this kind of laptop angle, or a FaceTime screenshot, or a porch portrait, or any of that stuff again, I don't ever want to see it again. Because it's just going to be like, oh my God, that time was so shit.
Well, I've seen some nice examples. And in terms of the webinar conversation, like, I can't wait until I get to do one of these in person with someone. Because like, they've all been over camera, and like, I've kind of got used to that format. But it's also, it's really maddening just seeing yourself all the time in a Zoom call or a webinar chat or whatever.
Yeah, I like that in Zoom. You can turn yourself off in Zoom. So when I'm in Zoom, I do that because I don't want to like get distracted. Because I was watching I think it was either ICP or Aperture did a talk with, I think it was Justine Kersland, and she was publicising a new book, and it was over Zoom, and it was like everybody was on Zoom listening to her talk and share her screen. But and she's like, I don't know, you kind of have an idea of people. And she's in her 40s, and like, she's a proper like artistic documentary photographer and that kind of fine art person that you just have reverence for. And all of a sudden she was like, oh, does my hair look all right? And I was like, you shouldn't be thinking about that. You should be thinking about your art. But it just shows that we all
everyone has that insecurity as soon as you're looking at a screen.
I don't want to see myself. I don't think you can turn yourself off on this, unfortunately. But on Zoom, that's the first thing I do, just because I don't want to be, I'm self-conscious enough. I don't need to see myself being self-conscious.
Well, I'd like to see something which reflects on the total disconnect. You know, like, there's this whole thing of like, oh, we're all in this together, or like, you know, capturing stuff through a webcam, trying to work as you would normally, but like, I've seen a couple of things, but it's like, I'd like to see something which really kind of looks at how fragmented it makes social interaction, and how difficult, and how you get those connection dropouts. And I don't know. Anyway, that'd be fun.
It's strange. It's kind of like the antithesis of everything that I like about my job, is that connection and being able to feed off of another person's energy, and they feed off of you, and you kind of have this little dance. And sometimes I'll go to a shoot where the person just doesn't want to be there. They don't want to collaborate. They have no energy. And it's like, it's excruciating, because you're like trying to just like pull something out of them and then pull it out of you as well. And I imagine doing something like that over Zoom is like really similar in an excruciating, horrible way that I want no part of.
But anyway, How long have you been in San Francisco?
I moved here immediately before lockdown. So
oh right, okay, so super recently.
I've been living. I lived in New York for 7 years. And I moved to LA. I lived there for 3 years. And I moved here in January. Mm-hmm. And I was just kind of, like, my boyfriend lives here, which is why I came here. So I moved in with him and just sort of like finding my feet and settling in and figuring out how to do work and like still going to back and forth to LA a bit. And actually, like, the week before lockdown, I had like a super, super stressful, busy week with just lots of jobs and multitasking and stuff, which is good because financially
in hindsight, quite good.
Yeah, it was good because it kind of like means that this time hasn't been as scary as it could have been financially. But yeah, I was just settling in, just kind of like finding my feet and thinking about what I was going to do here and meeting people and just like exploring this new land that I was now a part of. And then all of a sudden I'm just trapped in a house.
Explore your own home.
Yeah. My boyfriend and I have just moved in together and we're like, cool, we've been with each other 24/7. So looking at the same four walls every day. So it's been interesting to move to a new place and not actually get to see any of it.
Yeah. It's been a gradual introduction.
Yeah. It'll be nice when we can like just go to a restaurant or just go and explore. I went into San Francisco on one of the days and I went to the Palace of Fine Arts, which is like a big weird, I think it's a Beaux Arts building, like a round building in the city that's usually packed with tourists. It was completely empty and that was actually quite nice. And it actually, there was no traffic for a start and I was like, oh, I could get used to this no traffic thing, like this is brilliant. Like going over the bridge, like it was just sailed over in like 10 minutes or something. And then I find that whenever I kind of make a plan to go to something that's like a big tourist attraction, you've seen pictures of it and you think it's going to be like empty, like in the picture. And then you get there and you're like, what are these fucking people doing? And it always annoys me, even though I'm like, I'm one of those people. So like, you know.
Yeah. But I know what you mean. It's always the worst. I mean, people don't mind having the people. I don't want the people there.
Yeah, exactly. But like getting somewhere and seeing that it was completely empty and just being able to enjoy it without influencers and selfie sticks. And it was just quite nice to just have a place to myself apart from like the odd person walking around and giving each other a wide berth and stuff. But yeah.
Yeah. So what took you to New York originally?
I don't really know. I just liked it there. I know it sounds stupid, but
Have you always been drawn to American life and American culture?
Yeah, it was always something like the culture, the aesthetic. I think kind of growing up, I watched a lot of movies and my grandparents, I don't know why. I think they came over here a lot, I think, but they had things like, my nan had a horse when I was really small, but it was a Palomino horse, which at the time I didn't know that was quite an odd thing to have in the UK. Whereas over here, it's like the Western, it's that gold one with blonde tail and mane. That's like quintessential, like Western horse. Yeah. And she wasn't horsey in like the kind of horsey way. They had a farm and like cows and shit. So it was like, you know, not posh horsey, but she had a Western saddle as well, which is the one with the pommel rather than the the little mound that we have in England. And they both had Stetsons, and my granddad's sister.
They sound cool.
Yeah, like they just, I think they were enamored by America and the American West. And you know, I wish they were still around so I could actually ask them, like, why did you have a Western saddle and a Stetson in Cambridge? Yeah. Like what?
In Cambridge, okay,
in the fens of Cambridgeshire, why? Why? But his sister lived in Massachusetts and they went over there a bit and just used to bring things over. My dinner plate there was a Massachusetts souvenir plate, which is funny because my boyfriend is from Massachusetts, so I was eating the plate where he was growing up at the time. And yeah, just movies and like the whole, yeah. And we went to America when I was a kid, when I think I was 7 or 8. We went on a big family holiday and it was like a full-on 3-week Disneyland, San Francisco, LA. I don't really remember it because I was too young, but just, I remember it was in the late 80s. So it was when movies would come out in America, like a year before we got them in the UK. So I remember going to see Three Men and a Baby at the cinema here and being able to go back to school and be like, I've seen it. And just like bringing over, like, because globalization wasn't how it is now, where you could buy stuff here Like, I tried root beer for the first time, and just all this stuff that you just didn't get in the UK. Yeah. And I just
bringing back a CD and then realizing it's a region two. Like, what's a region two?
Oh, I forgot about that. Yeah, regions. Oh my god. Yeah, it's a different world.
And were you always creative? You know, like, when did you kind of first start shooting and picking up a camera?
Well, I didn't come from an artistic background whatsoever. Like, it came that my school was very academic, and I feel like I've sort of internalized this. I don't remember it ever explicitly being told to me that, like, art was basically just fannying around, but it's something I've internalized. Like, yeah, you can do that, but get a real job, kind of thing. You know, it's a fair statement thinking. But yeah, didn't have any, like, my school wasn't artistic at all, and academics were kind of the thing to concentrate on. But my mum was always documenting. Like, we always had cameras around, and there's a picture of her at Disney World with, like, this enormous video camera on her shoulder. Mm-hmm. And it's like, I can't imagine dragging that around Disney World all day.
A classic cassette camcorder.
It was a cassette one, and enormous. So she always liked having little gadgets like that to document, and we had a lot of cameras. And I think I was all, like, early on, I had this kind of, maybe this sense of impermanence and wanting to, like, freeze a moment and bottle it and keep it forever. Because I think a lot of the documenting my mum did were the happier times, and, like, being on family holidays, and because, like, home wasn't exactly a happy place. So when we were on holidays, everything was kind of nice. And so those are my childhood photos. And I like that those moments are frozen in time, and it's the happy moments that are frozen. My dad worked in the music industry, and she kind of worked for my dad's company, and she ran fan clubs. So she would, and he did merchandise. So they would be on tour a lot, and she would be documenting bands on the stage and, like, doing music photography, but only with, like, a crappy film camera. Although it's probably quite a nice camera for its time. I still have it.
She probably has a pretty killer access as well.
Yeah, exactly. Like, she just used to wander, and it was before the days where people were like, where are you going to put that? So she could just kind of do whatever she wanted. So we've got lots of, like, old tour photos of The Cure, and I think there's the Sex Pistols and all kinds of stuff.
Nice.
So I was always very, I always loved documenting as well. Like, as a teenager, you know, school trips, we used to, the headmaster at our school loved Europe. Like, he loves Germany and France. So we used to go to Germany and France on school trips. And it was always, like, the grey, miserable parts of Germany and France. It was never anywhere interesting. But it would just be like this, just a bunch of rowdy teenagers, like, on holiday together, basically. And I was always documenting it and just taking pictures. And I used to love, at the end, like, going to Boots and getting them processed and, like, getting the prints back. And I'd always taken tons, and, like, just going through them. And I love that about film now, is, like, the forgetting what you've taken and not being able to see it instantly, and then getting the film back and being like, oh, yeah, I forgot I did that. I was always, like, aware of and wanting to document, and always had, like, a disposable camera or a crappy little point-and-shoot camera. But, I don't think I ever thought of photography for me, I suppose, was just something that someone did as a hobby, or took pictures of your family and stuff, because that's what I'd internalised and that's what I'd seen. So, yeah.
Sure. Did you get taken to a lot of those early gigs with your folks?
Yes. I was at my first Glastonbury when I was 2. There's a picture of me in the kids', like, creche area or something. I remember being on the Joshua Tree tour with you 2.
Oh man, that's wicked.
I don't, obviously, to me, it was all, at the time, it was, like, just what my parents did, so it was normal. I was very small as well. I think I was 6 when we did some of my dad would kind of go out to some shows just to, like, check everything was running okay. We wouldn't be on a tour bus or anything. I think they did follow a tour bus for a few dates at one point, just my parents. But I do remember, like, I remember being sat on a flight case backstage with my sister, and we'd just sort of been dumped there because my parents were busy. And I just remember being, like, bored, shitless, and just like, oh, when can we go home? And I saw, and I've got this really clear image of you, all of you two, walking through a hallway that was through a door that we could kind of see. And they were all wearing white dressing gowns, and they all sort of, like, wave to us because they'd seen it. They knew us like as just mm-hmm. being around. They'd known us since yeah. I was a baby. And they all waved to us, and I was like,
because
I just
boring.
Didn't want to be there.
Yeah.
But you just take that's it awesome. All for granted. Yeah, but my sister loved Bross, and my dad would get tickets to take her to uh-huh. Bross concerts, and I loved the Cranberries when I was 14, and they supported REM at Milton Keynes Bowl when I was 14, nice. And my dad got tickets, and I remember not being interested in REM, so we just went for the Cranberries and left. Mm-hmm. Didn't yeah. even see the headliner. Oh, and my dad made me bootleg t-shirts as well because I loved suede when I was 11 and uh-huh. I desperately wanted this suede t-shirt that was in Spinner Disc in Northampton, but it was 12 okay. pounds and I didn't have 12 pounds and he was like, you're not spending 12 pounds, because obviously he knew how much t-shirts actually cost sure. me. He was like, I'm yeah. spending 12 pounds 12 quid on a t-shirt, no. And yeah. he got one of the art people at the company to make the logo on a silk screen because he had a factory, like they did it all in Northampton in the factory mm-hmm. and he got the factory to like bootleg me 10 different suede t-shirts, which were just different colorways of the logo.
That's ace. Yeah,
so,
what a legend.
So I have my own bootleg suede merch.
yeah. So then what point, I suppose, if you never saw photography was possible, what were you kind of aiming, you know, kind of what was your direction before? And then also how did you kind of get onto photography being something that you thought, oh, I can make a livelihood out of this?
Yeah, so I went because my parents worked in the music industry, and then when my dad remarried, my stepmother worked at a record label.
Okay.
And when I was 14, I think I was 13 or 14, I went to do like work experience at the record label, and I went around to every single department. She set up this thing for me to go around to every department and like chat to the head of department just to see what it was about. And I remember the head of Silvertone Records played me Stone Roses' first demo, and it was fucking dreadful. And when he turned it off, I went, like, I was only 14, so I didn't really. I went, yeah. You signed them because yeah. of that. It was awful. But I went to the press department, and I liked the idea of doing that. And I'd like kind of off and on did work experience a little bit, and I opened Backstreet Boys fan mail in the days before the internet and stuff, when people still had fan clubs. And then that was kind of my aim. And I applied to go to university to study public relations, which looking back was a huge mistake because I got there and I was like, this is a Mickey Mouse course. I'd come from like quite an academic school. Mm-hmm. We didn't do stuff like media studies or business studies or anything. It was like, I did English, French. And I remember I did psychology A level, and that was like the wacky choice at my school to do psychology. So I kind of went to a university where it was Leeds Met as well. So it wasn't like, it was basically a PE teacher factory at the time. And everyone was wearing shell suits and like, sitting around the union vomiting into bin bags and stuff, and I was like,
it sounds like Leeds.
Oh, I was like, what have I done? I hated it from the first moment I was there. I was like, oh, this was a big mistake.
But a good music scene in Leeds though.
I don't remember going to anything in Leeds. I've never really people were shocked because I have done a lot of music photography I'm not really a big music head, or like if I don't want to go to a gig or a festival like for fun. Like I used to a little bit, but now especially I'm like, oh, fuck no.
there seems to be an energy that you meet somewhere with the music though. If it's not the music itself, like there's an atmosphere.
I think music when I was a teenager, when I think back to kind of being like so miserable, but the only time I was happy was when I was in my bedroom and I had my stereo. And actually, I think it might have been Paul Epworth, he tweeted a couple of months ago, it looked like it was a page from Music Week, like when they print the chart in Music Week, and it was the chart from a certain week in 1995. And I looked at it and I was immediately back in my bedroom, and I knew, like, I think it was the album chart, and he'd basically like highlighted all the albums that he worked on in that chart that week.
Right.
And like even the albums where like I didn't like the artist, I still knew loads of songs because I listened to the radio and the charts and watched Top of the Pops. And I think music was definitely really important to me as a teenager, but I didn't have any like discerning taste or anything. I remember I was talking about liking Suede when I was 11 or 12, which sounds like I was quite a cool 11 or 12 year old, which I kind of was. But my other favorite was also Bon Jovi. Like Suede and Bon Jovi were like my thing. So
you know, Bon Jovi is kind of cool. There is a little bit of it's kind of cool.
Keep the Faith is a great record. I stand
absolutely
by
that. You know, like good amount of cheese, but also quite cool.
Yeah, great. Yeah. And he has great teeth as well. Like, yeah. So yeah, music was never really the reason. It's difficult to explain why. I remember watching Top of the Pops and thinking, I want to know what's happening when behind the camera in the bits that we're not allowed to see. And I always wanted to see that. And I think a bit later when I actually started working in music PR, I got to go to Top of the Pops. And I remember being in a lift. And I think it was Ricky from the Kaiser Chiefs was in the lift with us. And I remember thinking like, huh, this is what I used to wonder was happening behind the scenes. It's like, I mean, now I've been behind the scenes a lot and the answer is like not much is happening behind the scenes, but I still like knowing secrets and like knowing things that other people don't know.
Yeah.
And I
think what's going on behind the surface.
Yeah, and it's always like the mundane shit that excites me the most. Like whenever I do a shoot with someone famous, I end up asking them like really mundane questions, because I think another common thread through my work is I'm always trying to look for what we have in common, like as people. And I think that's what I find quite difficult about the way of things now, where everything's so divisive and everybody's kind of got their label and their box. And I'm constantly looking for that feeling of connection and like what makes us the same. Like that's I'm always looking for. And so I think I went to Moby's house for a shoot a year or so ago, maybe longer. And I'd seen him on an E! Channel show called Celebrity Medium or something, where like a celebrity talks to a medium that talks to ghosts.
That sounds really weird.
And so
only in America.
Yeah, it's the channel that brought you the Kardashians, basically.
Uh-huh.
And
Hollywood
Medium, that's what it's called, Hollywood Medium. And it's just this psychic kid that talks to celebrities and their ghosts.
Yeah.
And Moby was on it, which always struck, because it would usually be some like weird, like Melissa Joan Hart from Clarissa Explains It All, like some crappy celebrity. And then Moby was on it. And I remember watching the Moby one just being like, what is he doing on it?
So but Moby, how did you go from New York hardcore punk to this Moby?
But that, I think that's what I found interesting. So when I had my shoot with him, that's pretty much all we talked about. Yeah. And like, after the shoot, I was like, oh my God, Moby's done all this like really amazing stuff. And I asked him about Hollywood Media because I wanted to know like if it was edited, how it was edited and if it was real. And and he said that guy's legit. So there you go.
Yeah. I mean, he gets asked about the other stuff all the time. You know, no one asks him about Hollywood Mystic.
I have actually noticed a couple of times where I'll ask somebody a question and they'll just kind of be like, they've never been asked that before. And they're like, okay.
Yeah. So that's cool. And so going back to your horrible days at Leeds Met, how did that then transition into, I'm going to be a photographer?
Well, no surprise, I quit. I dropped out, but it took me 2 long years of not trusting my instincts, even though I knew within the first week that I was like, I do not want anything to do with any of this. Mm. And then there was like a gap, not a gap year, like a, what's it called? A placement year.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
And all the placements were all like doing PR for the gas board. And I was like, I didn't come here for that. And all the teachers had like worked at places like British Gas in PR. Mm. And I was just like, this isn't what I came here for. So I just thought, if I'm going to leave and do my placement year, but I'm going to try and get a job and not come back. Because I thought, I can't really leave and have nothing to go. I needed a reason to be able to say to myself, and probably mostly to myself, but my parents, not that they really gave a shit, but to say like, I'm not going back because I'm doing this. And I got a job at Freud's, which is like that huge PR company. Okay. And their way of doing things was that you started on reception for 6 months and then you got to move up onto one of the teams, and they had a music PR team, although the music PR team did like Blue and Jerry Halliwell at the time. So it wasn't exactly
the good stuff. Cool. Yeah.
It was very tabloidy. But after 3 months, they promoted me to one of the teams, and it was mostly just like doing press cuttings and shit. It was pretty miserable. But I learned more in my first week of being on reception, like just listening and taking things in and just even answering the phones and talking to certain people, than I did in the whole 2 years. And I was just like, I'm not going back to that. So I stayed at Freud's for a bit and got paid terrible money, and then I left there and I temped at record labels, like just doing...
Is this in London really? At this stage?
Yeah, in London. Yeah. I did quite a few stints at Polydor. I loved it. That was probably the only like regular job that I loved was being at Polydor. And then I got a job at Outside Organization, which kind like that led me to be doing music events like festivals and stuff. And I thought I'd wanted to do artist PR, but now looking back, like if you'd have put me on a long artist album campaign, like I like things that are quick, have a deadline. Mm-hmm. You work towards that deadline, then it's done. Which is what doing the events did. So we did like Isle of Wight Festival, and I would always, the lowliest job at an event was always being in the pit with the photographers. But I loved it because I got to get away from like the boss and all the people I worked with and all the journalists. And I got to just like stand in the pit and like be at the gig, and the photographers were always really nice. And I got to see what, like, look at their screens. And I was always interested in what they were doing, even though like I didn't notice it at the time. That I don't know. I'm really bad about talking about things.
No, it was in the corner of your eye, though.
Yeah, it's now more with hindsight that I can look and be like, yeah, I was like interested in what they did, and just used to sort of like have a lot. They were all like agency photographers with their little stepladders and stuff, and they were all like middle-aged grumpy bastards, most of them. But I really liked them all, and so
yeah, for the three songs and then ready to get out.
Yeah, and they would bitch about everything, but I would just sort of like rib them, and I just I really liked it, even though it was like the lowliest job there. And Brian Rasick was one of the photographers who he was always my favorite. Like I would always take care of him because you always have a little bit of power as the PR. Like my boss didn't like Brian, for instance, but I would always make sure that he got like the best access because he was always nice me, and he just seemed like a really lovely man. And I remember every Christmas, this was when I moved on to LD Communications, I think they're called LD Publicity now, I don't know. That was miserable. But every Christmas, the photographers would come and kind of give us Christmas presents, and like everybody would, and it was basically just kind of like suck up and make sure that we gave them.
They get the gigs for next year.
Gave them like special access. It wasn't sucking up. It was like, it was networking and good business sense, basically.
Sure.
And so there was like, and I think it was my first year there, and everybody was like, oh, the photographers come in, they're going to give us Christmas presents. Like sometimes we get like gift vouchers and this and that. And I think somebody did come and like, we did get gift vouchers, but Brian Rasick came in and he just had an exhibition of all his old work. And he emailed everybody to say that I want to give you a Christmas gift. I want to give you all a print from my exhibition. Here they all are, pick one and let me know which one you want. And like, everybody in the office started bitching about what a shitty present that was because they wanted the vouchers.
Wow, that's awesome. What? No
and
way.
And I was like, I just felt really touched that he was giving something so personal. And the one I picked was a black and white, really tight portrait of Robert Smith from The Cure. And it was from around the time my parents were working with them. And I got that one. And it's still, and it's like an exhibition print. So it's on like the foam core. And it's still something I treasure to this day. And I was just like, oh, this is such a special gift.
That's so cool. What a nice dude.
Yeah, so, and I see him from time to time if I'm working in London, and he's still bitching and moaning about being like a pit photographer. But yeah, I was just always interested in that side of it. And I remember when I kind of left London, I moved to Sydney, Australia for a bit, just because, which is going to be something you hear a lot, because I just do shit.
Well, you're a traveller.
I think I just got to a point in London where I just had enough, and I was 20, 24, 25, and like I'd been working at that PR company, and it was just like, it was so toxic and horrible. And I don't think I'm built to work in that kind of environment. Like I'm not really a 9-to-5. I sort of like to make my own rules, as it were, which did not fly there, definitely. But I got
You're a Californian at heart.
Well, I think I'm more of an, since coming to the West Coast, I think I'm more of an East Coaster, but yeah, I'm kind of like super chilled out, but super anxious and like on edge all the time, but actually my boyfriend says that I'm chilled out about really big things and really like neurotic about tiny things that don't matter, yeah. which is pretty accurate. Yeah. Like huge uh-huh. decisions, like huge life altering decisions, I'll be like, give that a bash. Whereas like, yeah. oh my God, what are we going to have for dinner tonight? Will be like a huge, yeah. like
huge stress.
yeah. So yeah, I just decided to go to Sydney, and I had never been there before, didn't know anybody there. I think I'd always wanted to go there because I grew up watching Neighbours and Home and Away and Heartbreak High, and it just seemed like this fabled faraway yeah. land where they still spoke English, so it wouldn't be that hard. Nice weather. Yeah. And I just decided, and it was easy to get a visa, so I just decided to do that. And cool. I had lunch with Brian Rassick before I went, and I asked him if I could buy one of his... I had no idea about cameras or anything. I had a Sony Cybershot that I used to take and like take pictures of my friends and gigs and things. And that was the first time I remember getting that ooh feeling where you know you've like got something, was with that crappy little camera. But I wanted to have like an SLR, even though I didn't really know what that meant. And I said to Brian, I was like, are you ever, like, have you got any old cameras you want to sell or something? And he said to me what I always say to people now, it's like, don't bother lugging an SLR around, like, unless you're going to buy all the like the good glass to go with it, like just get a really good point and shoot. Like, you don't want to be lugging that beast around. And
not terrible advice whatsoever.
Yeah, and he kind of said that, and then I went off and bought a crappy Samsung DSLR that was like just one of those, basically a point and shoot in the shape of an SLR. And I used that in Australia. And I think that's where I kind of properly, because that's where I was exploring and seeing new places and new landscapes and things. I think that's where I kind of got the bug for doing it. But it still wasn't, it didn't occur to me that it could be a job. It was just something I liked doing. And I worked at a record label there as well. So it was, I was still the same sort of thing. But just me and a crappy SLR going to Ayers Rock and...
That's cool. So was there any particular break that happened?
Yeah. So when I was in Australia, I worked for a tour promoter and a record and Universal Music. And I was also doing freelance writing on the side. And that started when I was in London, where Clash magazine asked me to interview. I think I'd been emailing the editor and he said that I was a good writer from my emails. And he just out of nowhere asked me to interview a band for them. And I was like, I was kind of at a point where I knew that I was getting sick of what I was doing. And I was like, may as well. So I did that. And then when I was in Australia, I kind of blagged my way into freelance writing. I wrote album reviews for the Sydney Morning Herald, which I don't know how I managed that. Like, I look back, and I'm like, why did they let me do that? But I did that and I wrote for like OK Magazine and... I just email people just saying I'm a freelance writer, even though I had no business doing that. And they believed me, so I did
it. Wow, that's cool. Yeah. Gift of the gab.
Yeah, I think it's more like just ignorance and like fearlessness and just not knowing any better and just
saying I can do it.
Yeah. And it's something that I wish I still had, because I don't think I've got that as much anymore. Just the balls just to be like, fuck it, like, what's the worst that can happen?
I'll give it a go.
I want to go back in time and just be like, are you insane? But so I did that. And then when I came back to London, I went to New York for the first time and I was just like, oh my God, I love it here. This is my place. I want to live here. And within a year, I decided that I was just going to move there, initially for 3 months. On a tourist visa and just like
make it work.
Yeah, that was like my exact thought, was just like, I'm just gonna go and see what happens. And then I fell in love with it, obviously. And then I came back to England and I did some freelancing at magazines in England writing, and then just got one of those journalist visas and saved up as much money as I could to like come back and start an entirely new life. And I had no money and no job or career or anything. And I was 28 and I don't know how I did it, honestly. I don't know how I made it work, because it just sounds terrifying to me now.
But it worked out.
It worked out. I think I feel like maybe it was meant to be, like stars aligned and just doors opened. And I just sort of, you know.
Well, I think that there's something to be said for having a, I can do that attitude.
Yeah, Yeah, and I did freelance write. I did freelance writing for NME, and then I think Clash again asked me to interview a band called The Drums, and I just upgraded my shitty Samsung SLR to a slightly less shitty Canon SLR.
What was it? Do you remember?
They call it a Rebel over here.
Oh, like the Rebel. Yeah.
Like, was it 500D rings a bell?
Oh, yeah. Classic.
Yeah. So, with the little pop-up flash and stuff.
The world of sub 10 megapixels.
I shot on auto. Like, I shot JPEG. I did not know anything at all.
Yeah.
But for some reason, when Clash said, "Can you interview The Drums?" I said, "I'll do it if I can do the photo shoot as well."
Okay. Cool. Yeah,
looking back,
I can do it.
Like, oh my god, what was I doing?
Yeah.
And thank God, like luckily for me, The Drums, now I know better, but at the time I was like, yeah, I'm pretty good at this. But it wasn't me, it was them. Like, they were good at it. Like, I went on to work for them a lot more, and they know how to do a photo shoot. Like, the singer just didn't. They just knew how to do those tiny little moves that bands often don't know how to do. So I completely lucked out, and I had them to be good for me, so I could sort of think that it was me doing it, but it wasn't at all.
Yeah.
And then I loved doing it. I loved the act of doing the shoot, and then I loved getting pictures back and like being on the computer and kind of putting probably awful like filters and things on them, because it was before I didn't know it. I think I had like Photoshop Elements or something, thought that was enough. And then
but that's a great first break, you know, because you could have easily been shooting someone who just made you feel tiny for not knowing what to do.
Exactly. And the second band I shot had no idea what they were doing, and I remember actually like manhandling one to like put him in, because they had no idea. And I came away from that just being like, oh my god, like that was awful. And it was because I didn't know enough to know that The Drums were just so good at it that they allowed me to do what I still like doing now, which is just, I like moving around, I like working around, I like letting people do what they want to do and be themselves. Mm-hmm. And I move around them, and I kind of engineer stuff. Like, I see what they're doing, then I engineer it from there, rather than being full on going in with this dodgy concept and make them be something that I want. I want people to be themselves. I think I had a lot of good fortune and serendipity. And actually, after that, I didn't pick up a camera for another 6 months. I don't know why. I don't know why. And then the Future Heads were playing, and I was reviewing them for NME maybe. And I just decided to take my camera along, and I took some pictures, and I think maybe I put them on Twitter, or it was way before Instagram. So I don't know how the singer would have seen them, but
was it the good old days of Flickr?
I don't think it was. It might have been Facebook. Was it Twitter? It was something, but he messaged me on whatever it was that I'd put them. It must have been Twitter, but it was before Twitter. I don't know. But he messaged me, and he said, "You've got a good eye." And I look back at those photos now, and they're awful. But there is something there. But my camera was really bad, and I think I was probably still using the kit lens at that point. I'm not sure if I'd upgraded to the heady heights of the 50mm 1.8 yet. But he said I had a good eye, and that just sort of like, it flipped a switch. That's like somebody that I thought knew what they were talking about, because he'd obviously seen a lot of pictures of himself. And so I sort of credit Barry Hyde from the Future Heads for making me think, do you know what? I like this. I want to do this. And it was the first thing that I'd ever done that. Because even though I was like a good writer, and people told me that I was a good writer, I didn't like doing it. I didn't like the sitting down and the writing. It just was like a labor. Like, it was just, it was hard work. Whereas when I took pictures, even though I was shit at it and I didn't know any better, and I always just wanted to get better, and I was always just hungry to get better. And that's still with me, I think. Like, I don't think that ever goes away.
You had more of a passion for what was coming from it than the writing. I don't know. Did you finish a written piece and be like, oh, that's something I'm really proud of, in the same way that you can with a photograph?
I remember when I did, I worked for Stylist magazine and I wrote, they did like a New York issue and I wrote this big travel guide to New York, and they, I think I just like on the off chance sent them a couple of pictures that I'd taken when I was there, and they printed them, and it was, there's a, like a little, it was not even like the main picture. It was like these two tiny drop-ins of, there's one of Central Park and one of the Guggenheim Museum, and like not even a byline on the page, but the byline that goes along the gutter, and it said pictures Rachel Wright, comma, and I think it was either Getty or Rex Features. And like I'd had byline, I'd had bylines like with my name big, like on things that I'd written, but that teeny tiny, I took a picture of it because I loved that I got a picture credit, even though nobody would ever read that or see it. And I felt I actually felt like proud of that, prouder than anything else that I'd done.
Rachel's hit the big time.
It's straight. And even now, like if I see my byline in queue, especially if they do like a really nice page design and they make it look a bit funky and they do something a bit weird with it, I always just be like, huh, that's me. That's weird.
Yeah, that is cool. Nice. And I think there's definitely something that I can see, going back to what you were saying about wanting to work around artists and not kind of be too forceful with whatever concept or whatever you want to put in there. And does that mean that you're not someone who necessarily kind of uses lighting on location and tethers and has all of the kind of big setup for a shoot? You know, you're quite simple and free.
Yeah, I am pretty, like, I try and be quite lo-fi because I don't like being hemmed into one spot, because I find, especially if I'm on location somewhere, I'll be there and I'll just happen to look up and I'll see something that I didn't see before in another spot where the light's amazing. Yeah. And I don't want to be tied down to one place. And because I've had that before where I have had bells and whistles and I've looked over and been like, oh, we don't have time to go over there. And I really want to. I like being able to be like, oh, over here, and like kind of make
that spontaneity.
And I think, you know, a lot of people, and I definitely say this when I didn't know a lot about lighting, I like natural lighting just because they're afraid of using light, because lighting is really scary. And and like there's a photographer called Art Streiber who I follow on Instagram, and he does all those BTS things, and I like I look at the productions and it makes me tired just looking at the picture, because he's got like,
I mean, I'm not convinced all of those lights are turned on, but
sometimes I'll see the resulting picture first and I'll try and guess. I'll look at it and I'll be like, that's one light. That looks like one light.
Yeah, exactly.
And then I'll look.
You had
and it's
eight
like,
lights on the background.
Yeah.
You know?
It's like, what do you need all those people for? What do you need the wind machine for? Like, I just, I can't, I don't think I'd have the patience or tolerance for that. Like, I do like working with an assistant because it's nice to have a second pair of eyes and like an extra comedian to keep somebody entertained while I'm doing something. But quite often it's just them with like a sun bounce or a reflector. But I like to just, I'm not very technical in the sense, I remember I had an assistant who was very, very technical and he wanted to know like down to like dialed in settings and exactly what I wanted. And I was like, I don't know, just like, I told him at the beginning, I was like, I like my lighting to be quite flat and quite poppy. And like, he was like, but what about shaping the faces? I was like, no, just like,
you're not what I'm looking for.
No. And he was like a robot. And I was like, oh no. And I would try and like have jokes with him and he just wasn't having any of it. No. And an assistant I discovered right before lockdown was like my kind of assistant.
Yeah.
I want to have fun and have a laugh on a shoot because what we're doing is like usually quite ridiculous. As soon as I got an email to shoot Jeff Goldblum, I was like, oh my God, I need an assistant for this shoot just to have somebody to share it with, because everybody needs to be around this man. I didn't even need an assistant that day, really, because I knew where we were going to be and it was like one place. I need one setup so I could just throw up a light and be fine. But I was like, I need someone else to witness this so we can be afterwards and be like, together.
That's awesome.
Yeah, but simplicity goes a long way with me, and because I don't like shooting tethered, because it's that feeling of being locked in. I don't like feeling locked in, like tripod, tethering. I've shot in studios and, you know, it's fine, but I like being on location. I like environments. I like colours and textures and a bit, even if it's a bit of natural light that I can just balance with a soft lighter or something. I like something to look real, I think.
Yeah. And I think there's something even in the stuff that's the film shots that you've got on your site, you know, there's something which is, it's not overly precious. You know, it's kind of, it's more about the spontaneity than everything perfectly composed or this, you know, and there's, and that's, I think, well, it definitely comes through in what you're saying, you know, it's that kind of seeing something over there and going and getting it.
Yeah.
And, you know, that kind of freedom to just kind of experiment and try something different.
The moment is more, I said this yesterday, because I think I was listening to the Gerard Mankiewicz interview you did. And
he
said something, and as he said it, I said out loud, the moment is more important than the technical, because I think he was saying something similar about his old work where...
He was looking where it's like, it's not even in focus or...
Yeah, but and even though occasionally I'll have something that's like, this focus is a bit soft or something, but the next frame will be completely pin sharp, but the moment's gone, like the emotion's
gone.
Not
quite the same.
So I'll always pick the slightly less technical one, because you can spend some time trying to fix some of the technical stuff. It'll never be perfect, but you can fix technical. You can't fix an authentic emotion or a moment. So
an experience, yeah.
So I'm always looking for a real emotion. And I think a lot of the advertising stuff that I've been doing over the last couple of years I've been selected because they can see in my work that there's a lot of the tour stuff is like just sitting and waiting and anticipating and like knowing when the shot is, like being like thinking like, okay, something's going to happen here. There's going to be some sort of reaction. So you're ready for it. And some of the advertising stuff that I've been doing, I think just because they have smaller budgets now, they'll be filming an ad shoot. And I think this is like a new way of doing things. And they'll have a stills photographer doing what they call like over the shoulder. And I didn't know there was even a term for it. And it's horribly stressful and you shoot the shit out of it. But
you get like 5 minutes to do it.
Yeah, you kind of shoot while they're filming. And then you have your time at the end where the film crew will be walking in front of you and switch, even though they've been told like 5 minutes for the stills photographer, leave the lighting where it is. Nobody listens. They'll be turning off the lights and I'm usually quite good natured on a shoot, but I was on this 2 day shoot where they kept doing it and I was going, lights! shouting at
me. Whoever you're there to shoot is completely wasted and knackered and has no energy
exactly. And like a crew member had parked cross by and it's like, what, we've been doing this 2 days, what part of 5 minutes for the photographer don't you understand? But I think actually looking through, because I've just been looking through that the last shoot that I did, which was one of those over the shoulder shoots, and the ones where I've got my 5 minutes and I'm directing them and asking them to do stuff are a lot less natural than the ones where I'm just catching. Because a lot of the stuff that they're filming, I'm then saying, do that again for me, kind of thing.
Okay.
But because they know they're having their picture taken, they're a bit more like posy.
I've already done this for 3 hours today.
Yeah, and their face is hurt from smiling because it's usually like advertising, so they have to look happy. But the where I'm shooting them filming, they're move, and sometimes I'll even direct, like, I think I've done it on shoots with musicians as well. I'll be like, pretend it's like a music video and like move through it. And I'm going to shoot you through that movement rather than being like still each photo. I'll say, pretend I'm filming you. And I'll say like action or like, because I want.
Just try and speak their language.
Yeah. Just because I want it to be like natural. And if there is an emotion like that, and I'll try and make people, especially for this, I was looking at this ad shoot that I did yesterday where they do have to be smiling and laughing. And I can see where they're going like, oh, like pretending to laugh and where I've actually made them laugh. And it's like, it's a real laugh. And those are the ones that will get picked because it's real. And that's what resonates with me rather than just like a lifestyle laugh. Let's laugh at our salad. In fact, I gave that very direction to Robbie Williams a couple of months ago where I had to take a picture of him with a salad. And I said, okay, I want you to pretend you're a stock photo girl laughing at your salad. And he pissed himself laughing because he was just like, that's ridiculous.
Yeah. But then you never know what's going to work.
Yeah, yeah, but I got my shot because he laughed at his salad.
Yeah, that's cool. And there's a couple of things that I'd like to pick up on. But I mean, I suppose leading on from that, you know, because you make it sound quite simple, a transition from shooting a few music shows to then working in advertising.
Yeah.
You know, how did that kind of transition come about?
Ooh, I think I just...
Well, how are you able to get those gigs, you know, because a lot of people will be thinking, I have no idea how to break into the world of advertising.
Yes, and I still don't really. Like, it's something that I'm only just kind of getting into and seeing if I'm comfortable with it. And and I think the ad sheet that I'm talking about that I've just done was for WW, which is what Weight Watchers now is.
Oh, it's the new Weight Watchers. Yeah, new, yeah, the big rebrand.
Yes, big rebrand. Yeah. So, and there was supposed to be like a ton of other shoots and then lockdown happened. So I'm praying that they pick up on them. And I remember going into it thinking like, oh, Weight Watchers, like, because I like Bill Hicks kind of influences me a lot, and his.
Okay.
I remember being. I wrote down a list of my influences just a few days ago, actually, and there's obviously some photographers in there, but there was like other people, like Bill Hicks. Kind of, I was like, yeah, he like his way of thinking and the way he sees America, and like he's a big influence on me. And I remember watching.
I want to dig into that some more.
Okay. but I remember a particular joke of his where he says, "If you work in advertising, kill yourself." No, seriously, kill yourself. And I remember watching that when I was like 16 and being like, ha 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 ha. Now every time I'm doing an ad shoot, I think about that, and I think about like I'm letting Bill down. But I think I've worked out that as long as I'm doing something where I can keep my integrity and not feel icky with it, then I'll do it. And like the Weight Watchers thing, going into it, I was like, oh, this could be, this could give me the icky feeling, but you know, it's good money and I could make some good work out of it. You never know. But then actually being on the shoot, it was such a lovely, because it's all the part of the rebrand is all about like a holistic wellness thing rather than like, I'm skinny now. Like, and I was miserable when I was fat kind of thing. And the people that they use were real people who are genuinely like that, because part of the filming of the ad was them giving testimonials about who they are now because of their weight loss. And I was like crying at a couple of stories because I get fully involved, but I fall in love with everybody I shoot because I get fully involved with their story. And like some, and like going through the shoot, because there's, I think there's about 6,000 frames and I haven't even, since, because I just delivered all the raws to the client, I didn't even look at them and haven't looked at them since. So yesterday was the first time I actually sat and went through, and I found myself like, oh, that person was such a joy to be around, and like their joy comes through and they are genuinely happy with their new lives, and none of what they were pushing was about like that picture with the big trousers, like these used to be my trousers. And it felt like it was in line with the integrity thing, and I didn't feel gross doing it, and I don't feel gross knowing that I did that. But say if like a company, I don't know, like some big oil company, although oil money would be nice, I suppose. But I would really think twice about certain brands that I'm just like, I don't like what you stand for, and it would be a tough one. So
Well, I didn't see the Bill Hicks influence coming necessarily, just because like your work is so uncynical and unjaded, and not that Bill Hicks necessarily cynical and jaded, like there's more to him than that, but there's definitely a,
I think I have an irreverent man. You know? He is, and I think I have a certain like sideways glance irreverence that I kind of bring to a lot, what I feel like I bring to a lot. Like I try and kind of have like a playfulness and a humor and an irreverence to certain things. And I think, and actually, like when I redid my website, and I have a long term, I guess it's like, it's more of a collection than a project, American Spirit, which is my kind of ode to America. And putting that, like, it's always kind of been in the back of my mind to kind of put all that, all my American stuff together. But it was the last thing I did on when I put all my work together for my website, and I'd left it to the end. Not because I was like, it's going to be my masterpiece, but because it was going to be such a huge amount of work that I was just putting it off.
There's a lot of photos in there.
There's a lot. And it's like 10 years of me living here, basically, going all over the place. And I wanted, I think I like, I just pulled everything that I liked and that I felt worked with. Because I chose American, the name American Spirit, because one of the photos is like a convenience store at nighttime with a car parked outside of it with just a bit of the ambient light from the convenience store. And it's like one of those crappy 7-Eleven places. So it's got tons of signs in the window. One of them on the door is an ad for the American Spirit cigarette packet with the American Indian on the front. I've always loved that branding and the colors they use. And I was like, American Spirit, I like that, because I feel like I go out looking for the spirit of America when I go on my little funny little spirit quest to like see what I find.
But well, I'm sure it's a matter of time before they rebrand themselves with everything that's going on.
I was thinking that yesterday because I was like, because you mentioned it in an email that you wanted to talk about that, and I thought I remembered like that's why I named it that because I saw that picture again, and then I was like, oh no, they're probably going to change the brand.
They probably will. Yeah, get yourself a pack now.
So that's why it's called that. But yeah, I put that, by the time I got around to putting that together, it was literally the week of the whole uprising. So it was done. I made that, I curated that whole gallery with the backdrop of like protests going on literally like two blocks away from where I'm living. You could hear helicopters and sirens all night and watching the videos of the police brutality and hearing Black people and people of color and Native Americans talk about their experience of being here and living here and being American. And yeah, it was an interesting project to put together against that backdrop, because even like against the backdrop of Donald Trump being president as well, because I feel like since I moved here when Obama had just been elected the first time, it was a different world. And since 2016,
the American spirit is being challenged right now, for sure.
Yeah, it really is. And like and going through those images and just being like, why am I, because originally I used to take pictures as just like my ode to this fabled mystical place that I'd always wanted to come to, and there is a lot of that in there, but it kind of has this other like this other perspective to it now, because I know I've lived here 10 years, and I can, when I was pulling stuff, because some of that stuff is like from like 2010, 2011, and I'd only just got here and I didn't know anything about the place. So I look at that now and I'm like, oh bless, like I didn't know anything. And like now we know so much more, and like there's this, it's just, even before, or like, I think just before coronavirus, I was like, oh my god, do I really want to live here? Like, this place is bullshit. So it was an interesting time to put that collection together, and I kind of really thought about what I wanted. I didn't want it just to be a bunch of like nice postcards of America. And there is the odd one in there that is like a landscape that is just like, that picture's been taken a million times before kind of thing. But I wanted to dot it with those things, of those landscapes. But I kind of sat and went through it and like wrote down what themes I thought were emerging, like what I was drawn to and what I was interested in. And there was like the obvious things like the architecture and mid-century stuff and gas stations and neon and motels and diners, which I do love all of that stuff. But I think whenever I go out on one of my little trips, I do kind of scratch the surface and I'm like, oh, it's not quite as nice as I thought it was. And so like, there were elements of like homelessness in there. Like two of the people are homeless people that I spoke to, that one lived in his van because his house burnt down in the Malibu fires.
I think that's what's so it's what's so crazy about America. You know, it's hard not to love that like nostalgic iconography. Yes. But then on the other hand,
you
there's
scratch
this...
the surface and the American dream is just utter bullshit. And it's like nobody wins with the American dream, unfortunately. And I think that's becoming very clear that it's and also when I first moved here, Berkeley University is just up the road. And I went to a Native American history class there. A professor kindly let me come and audit her class, and it was about Native American history and philosophy and their mysticism and spirituality and stuff. So I'd learn a ton of stuff about Native American history that I didn't know about. And so things like, I've got a picture of the Wigwam Motel in Holbrook, Arizona, and it's one of my favorite pictures because I love like the juxtaposition of these old classic cars and these wigwams. But now I look at it and I'm like, oh, it's a bit icky because it's like the cultural appropriation, plus the Indians that lived then there, they didn't have wigwams. The teepees are a completely different part of America. And and also looking at Native American photography from back in the day has been really interesting. So yeah, I kind of wanted some Native American representation in that project, and I put the wigwams in there, but I've also got like a couple of national park rangers that are Native American, like Navajo, and some other bits and pieces that aren't like the stereotypical kind of But also, I don't think it's my place to like go to a Native American reservation and say like, "Hello, I want to take pictures of you because you're strange and exotic to me." Like that's there's Native American photographers that can do that. In fact, there's one called Cara Romero who's amazing, and she does do that.
Okay.
Even I'll though I'm very interested in their way of life and even like their modern way of life, because it just seems kind of awful how they've been treated, and not that recently. It's not my place to tell their story, I don't think, but I have reverence for it, and I still have reverence for America, and I think that project is my love letter to America, but I think there's a few digs in there as well. Like there's I purposefully put certain things together and next to each other to show the paradox, because America to me is like one big paradox. Like it's and I think in the UK I think we've kind of experienced that slightly since Brexit, because America has this two-party system which immediately just splits the country in half, whereas the UK we kind of had that three-party system, so but with Brexit it was like a single issue, divided the country half and half in the same way that America is always divided between Republicans and Democrats. And I think as British people, we now have a better understanding of that and the extremism and the hatred between the two sides, for want of a better word. And I find that really interesting about America, but also really sad. And
it'd be nice to have some liberalism come back into things. But anyway, that's taking things in another direction.
We've gone into politics, but a lot of my a lot of the things that I'm drawn to are very white bread, apple pie, American things, which are traditionally like white man stuff. Like I really want to go to the Wyoming State Fair because it seems like a step back in time with like sheep riding contests and a rodeo and cowboys and stuff.
Yeah.
But I find that again, when I do go to certain, because a lot of the places I go to, I went to Roy's motel and gas station in California where it's on Route 66 and they've had this derelict neon sign for years, and they renovated it and did a relighting ceremony in November, and I'd been back and forth to that spot a lot and I was like I want to drive, and I knew I was leaving LA, so it wasn't going to be kind of I say on my doorstep, it was like a 4-hour drive, but it wasn't gonna be as close to me, so I was like I want to go and like see this relighting ceremony, and just because I've only ever been there when there's nobody there, and it was this huge like it was kind of like being at a school fete. They had like a barbecue and a raffle, and they at sunset they had this big like fanfare and speeches, and like everybody there was like from my perspective, they seemed quite what like coming in with a judgmental attitude, I would be like, "You're all Republicans and you all voted Trump, I'm absolutely certain." But at the same time, I chatted to people, and it's that finding the common ground thing again. And I think we are also divided, that it's nice to kind of go into the other side and chat to them and see where you do have things in common, and that we're not all monsters to each other. And we were all there to enjoy this one thing that was happening that we were all interested in. And same with the eclipse as well. When the eclipse happened here and I went and took pictures at Griffith Observatory, like there were people of like all kinds of backgrounds there, young, old, black, white, Asian, like the full gamut, because it was LA, so obviously it's a diverse place. But everybody was looking at this one tiny speck in the sky, and everybody had the same reaction, which is like this feeling of awe where you just feel tiny. Like I kept noticing it happening, like a kid would do it, an old man would do it, they would get their eclipse glasses and they would put them on and they would look, and as soon as they did it they'd all go and I hadn't got any eclipse glasses, so I didn't know what they were seeing. And then somebody, again, you kind of like go around chatting to people, somebody lent me their glasses, and even though I'd seen tons of people doing it, I put them on and I immediately just went at the sky, because it's just a natural human.
You can't help it. It
just looked so weird. I didn't really understand what it was, and it makes you feel tiny. And I just looked around and everybody was enjoying it together. And it's, a feeling of togetherness and connection, no matter who you are or where you come from. I think that's definitely a common thread in what I want to be doing and hopefully what I have been doing.
Yeah. Well, you said something, I can't remember exactly what it was you said earlier, but it made me think, you know, back in the day, because it's only quite a recent phenomenon, this whole thing of, you know, like very kind of sharp divided categorization of people.
Yes.
And it always used to be the thing when I was young anyway, where it was like the rebellious attitude was like, don't put me in a box.
Yeah.
You know, like, I'm not going to be categorized. And now it's just like, fit me in as small a box as possible.
Yeah.
And don't talk about my box
if you're not in it. And it feels very isolating. I understand why that's happening. But for sure.
I mean, it's because all these things just have never been confronted before.
Like, it's such a huge, like, react. It's a reaction to something that's just been going on brewing for so long. And I completely understand it. But it does make me sad that I think I just have this intrinsic sense of like loneliness anyway. Not necessarily loneliness, but like aloneness and isolation. I think my work shows that I have some kind of like, I like isolation and melancholy, and but also kind of a pop of color in there to just like try and make it happy and jazzy. So to feel more isolated and separate from people, especially, you know, we've all been isolated and separate from people for months now, but it's made me realize how much I like human connection, because I don't feel like, you know, we've had it because of the pandemic, and also because everybody is kind of more extremely going into their boxes, and I just sort of want everybody to be together looking at an eclipse and not giving a shit about anything else.
Yeah.
But that's, I hear you. That is a mythical utopia that unfortunately we do not live in.
We don't, no. And I suppose to turn it in some way back to photography, you know, the way you've kind of described how you jumped from writing to photography, you know, it kind of feels like you're not, well, you don't want to put yourself in the box as I'm this and this is who I am. You know, I guess maybe, you know, is video ever something that you've kind of looked at as like, that's something I could do?
I've done it. Like I did some tour videography for churches and block party, and I didn't. It just never, I don't know, I think I did, like, you know, most photographers will have like photographer and director on their website, and it always seemed like that would be a natural progression because that's what everybody else did. And I did a bit of it, and, you know, it was okay, but it just didn't mesh well with me, and it kind of made me double down on like, I don't want to do that. I filmed like a little, I'm doing, because when I first moved here, I would go to the Golden Gate Bridge because I love the idea of like people gathering around something like that. That's like, it's an American icon. Mm. It's bright red. So it's like, it pops. And I wanted to do like an ongoing project of just keep going there and like seeing what I find and getting different angles and stuff. And I did drive over it and like filmed bits of it with a view to kind of making like a little montage. I like montages. I think that comes from liking movies.
Again, it's very Americanery.
Yeah, really. Like the montage in a movie with the, it's just, I love all that shit. But generally speaking, no, I don't. I know that everything, you know, photographers should be able to do motion and all of that. I mean, never say never. In 10 years time, I could be a movie director and you'll be like, well, I didn't think you were going to do that, but I don't think that's going to happen. And I'm not aiming for that to happen. I'm not, it's not.
Cool.
Yeah. I've kind of doubled down on the stills thing.
Yeah. That's cool. And with the American Spirit project, you know, as an outsider in the States, do you think that's something that you'll kind of always keep working? You know, do you think you'll always kind of be intrigued by that spirit in some way?
Yeah, I think I'm always drawn to like go on an adventure here and like just see. And I think because it is such a huge, like the country is enormous and there's so many different places, and it sounds really obvious, but the vastness of it means like the landscapes are so different, and the people, it's like in Europe, each country has its own language and its own culture. And I think I saw a stand-up comedy recently saying, do you think somebody in Hungary has anything in common with anything, someone from Scotland? Like, it's the same it's the same size. And I just love,
you
like,
you can go from the Golden Gate Bridge to the Wyoming Fair.
Exactly. You know? And it's, it's not actually that far away. But I think I like the idea of, I like being a fish out of water, and I'll always be foreign here. And now when I go back to the UK, I feel a bit foreign because I've been here for 10 years. So I'll always be somewhere in the middle. But I do feel like I'm an outsider here, and I can observe things in a way that an outsider would. And actually, weirdly, the people who kind of ever really have much to say about my American work are other foreigners. American people, because they've seen it all a million times. It doesn't, it's not exotic to
them. It doesn't
them.
Chime with them. Yeah, not really.
Like, to us, it's exotic and different, and it looks cinematic. And because we've all grown up with American culture and watching all their movies and TV, that it's like, oh wow, that place is real, kind of thing.
So what do you guys love so much about gas stations?
Yeah, exactly. So I think to them, it's not, like, to me, it's still fairly exotic. And, you know, I'm going to Yosemite next week, and I'm going to see those enormous trees, the enormous redwood trees that, like, I've seen pictures
of them. I've seen them. They're fucking amazing.
Like, I just really want to go and see a really big fucking tree. Everything's bigger
here. That's something to make you feel small.
Exactly. So, I'm always looking for that kind, that sense of awe that I think America can give you in so many different. Like, I wasn't prepared for the Grand Canyon. You've seen it a million times. And as I was walking up to it, I was with my mum, and I was kind of, I'd like tour manage this whole trip with her. So for me, it was like looking at a schedule and be like, we're going to go to the Grand Canyon. We're going to hike along this trail, blah, 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 blah. And I remember like going towards it and like just chatting aimlessly about what we were going to do. And we have to keep on the schedule because we've got to get here next and blah, 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 blah. And I like got to the bit where you could just like, it just sort of like yawned in front of me, and I like almost tripped over, and I was like, I get that kind of awe thing again, because even though I'd seen it a million times and thought I knew what to expect, I just couldn't,
you'd never seen it.
I couldn't believe like it, you have to see it to kind of get it. And I just was like stopped in my tracks, and schedule went out the window, and I was planning on, if my mum hadn't have been there, I would have been like hiking down to the bottom with a donkey, because you could or can. Mm-hmm. And even though that would have been a very bad idea because I was unprepared, but thank God she was there, because I could only do like the easy trail with her. But I love being a fish out of water and going somewhere and trying to understand what makes that place or what makes those people. And in America, there's so many opportunities to do that.
Yeah.
But I'm worried I'm going to run out of places.
Well, keep it up. It's a great project.
I will eventually run out of places to go. You'll probably find me living in an igloo in Alaska or something at some point.
Well, there's many worse things than that. No, it's awesome. Well, Rachel, I'll leave you to get on with your day. It's been really awesome to chat to you.
You too. Thank you very much for having me. It's been really nice to kind of be made to think about why I do things and be a bit more reflective, and just rather than being on the hamster wheel and just doing it. I've actually kind of had to sit and it's been nice to have this past few months to actually sit and think about it, but I actually had to kind of really think about how I'd answer questions about it yesterday. So thank you for giving me the opportunity.
Thanks for taking the time, Rachel. Awesome to meet you.